When it comes to hard work, there's one important rule. Pick the right tool for the right job. That's why Chevy offers a family of Silverado pickup trucks designed just for the job. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and put a Silverado in your toolbox.
Okay, Reggie, how you doing, buddy? Oh, man. You have the script? It's important to have that script. You know that. Very scripted podcast. Okay, let's do this thing. Put it in the books. Episode number 460, 460. All right. Three S's, star, smile strong. Okay, strap in, Reg. Here we go. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. And don't forget to tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. I mean, come on. Listening, yeah, you get points for that. But extra credit is always good. You never know when you might miss a few answers, and it's good to have that extra credit just to make sure, just to have in your back pocket in case you need it. Of course, if you like what you hear, you can always go to WGNRadio.com, go to the podcast section and listen or find the prompt for this podcast, and then listen to your heart's content. Oh, podcast after podcast after podcast. After all, we've been doing this podcast now for more than 9 years. Hundreds of podcasts like this one, which is number 460. 460. Once again, we love a podcast. We love anything when we count it down or count it up, whatever it may be, with a zero or a five. So 460. Got that zero. That's good. 40 podcasts to number 500. Wow. I haven't done the math. I should. But I would assume that here we are in, I guess you could say this is late March. Wouldn't you say that? I would. Mid-March. We're at mid-March. Yeah, mid-March. So you figure, I've got 40 podcasts to go. I'm just doing this, you know. I mean, you know, I did take Algebra 2 trig in high school. That's how far I went. So, you know, I'm a math whiz. So let's see. January, February, 4 weeks apiece. That's 8. Plus another 2 since we're at mid-March. That's 10. Got 40 podcasts to go once a week. That's 50. So, yeah, just as a ballpark, I'm just going to ballpark it, if you will. I would think sometime in the first or second week of January of 2026 will be episode number 500. Now, I think I may have told a fib there in the opening there. Once again, the show very scripted, as you know. You could tell. It's so linear. You know, there's no deviation here. Tight script. You can always tell. Don't you love when you see President Trump give a speech? Because you always know when he's going off the teleprompter and just winging it. He starts off And, you know, when, now, you know, I think we've become sophisticated enough to know now that, you know, when any public speaker is at a big kind of rally or big kind of venue, you always see those two little clear panels that are up. Well, that those are the screens by which the teleprompter words are reflected on, so that the speaker, whoever it may be, present or anyone else, can read the speech. And, you know, they don't want to put the screen in front of the person because that's where the camera is and that's where the audience is looking. So they put them a little to the side. So, of course, you'll notice that the good speakers try to do it as natural as possible. And you know, they'll look to one side as if they're speaking to this side of the room, and then they'll look to the other side and they'll speak to this side of the room, but they're reading their speech. And you can always tell when Trump is on the teleprompter, because he physically seems to turn his body toward the screen he's reading. And so that's a giveaway. If you watch, you know, and don't get me wrong, he's a fine public speaker, but that's a giveaway. From my good old days in public relations, one of the things I did was media train people to talk to the media, to give public speeches and things like that, or presentations, how to best communicate those, and gave them those little tricks. And if you see the really good public speakers, it will be very subtle. They will stand straight right in the middle, and they will look to the side and make it look very natural. There would be a very slight head turn. And they'll probably be reading more out of their peripheral vision. So they try to keep their heads really in the middle. And if you are in a big venue like that, people can't really see your eyes. And even if you're on television, unless they do an intense close-up, people can't really see the pure direction of your eyes. And so you could still be standing straight, looking straight ahead, presumably, with your eyes a little to the right or a little to the left, but with your posture straight and your head straight, and you could still look at those screens with your eyes without moving your body or your head, and it will look very natural. And then of course, you want to make it look sometimes like you're speaking to one side or the other as well. You just don't want to speak to the middle of the room. You want to look like you're including everyone. So then you can certainly move your head a little more, and then you could really read it straight ahead. But when Trump does it, you can always tell when he goes off. Not only is his head, and it almost sometimes his whole body shifts to the side, from the one side to the other, so you could tell he's reading. But the biggest clue, the next time you see him give a speech with those little, when you see those little clear little screens up by any kind of a major, address, it's not only the shifting of the body and the shifting of the head where you can really see and he really kind of focuses on it, but then he'll always repeat what he just said, or you could tell that the language is much more relaxed, and then you know he's off the prompter and he's speaking off the top of his head. And then all of a sudden, when he feels like he's done, then he'll suddenly put his hands on the podium again, and then he will turn and face one of those side screens and then begin to read it again. And you'll notice that the language is much more formal and more flowing, not as many pauses, because it's written right there. Whereas opposed to if you're talking off the top of your head, a lot of times you are searching for a word, you do some little pregnant pauses or some pauses there, you do some fillers to fill in the dead space, and you can always tell. But what I always enjoy about when I see him do one of those speeches is that you can always tell because he'll, if something while he's reading off the teleprompter, then he will, he'll if something really catches his attention that he feels he needs to punch a little more. I'd love to, I used to write speeches for people as well. And you know, these are kind of built-in things. It depends. Some people don't veer at all. They just read the speech. Some people will say, you know, I might go off the script a bit here, and you leave room for that. And the person who's actually working the teleprompter has to really listen, because that's literally done manually. You know, somebody is there on a machine with a button, and they're listening to make sure that they're keeping up the pace so that they're not too fast or not too slow as the person's reading. That text has to keep moving. That's not easy. But with Trump, it's got to be a nightmare to be working the teleprompter, because you never know when he's going to stop. And so you have to really, I assume that person has to be very ready to stop that, because all of a sudden, if there's some passage or some line that he's reading that he wants to expand on and overemphasize and maybe talk about off the top of his head, he will do that, and that teleprompter person has to stop the text from moving, because he's going to then do his little ad lib spiel, and then he's going to come right back, and he's expecting to be right where he needs to be, not repeating where he just was, or, you know, he needs to be. So that can't be an easy job to work the teleprompter for Donald Trump. But you can always tell if something in his prepared speech is something that he wants to punch a little more or explain a little more in his own words, as opposed to reading this speech that has been written. I mean, some people say that he works quite a bit, but for the most part, I would assume that he gets a draft, and then he might go in and do some editing himself and changing things. But if for the most part, it's written initially by someone else, and then he might come in and change a line here and make this sound, well, this is the way that I would say this and things like that. But for the most part, it's written by someone else. In fact, very interesting. My wife and I, when we went to Pearl Harbor in December, and we went to the Pearl Harbor Memorial, they had the actual speech that FDR, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, delivered to Congress to ask for a declaration of war after Pearl Harbor was attacked. And, you know, that was the speech that he famously said, December 7th, 1941, a day that will live in infamy. Well, that has become a classic speech and a classic line. And you'll hear people constantly quote that, a day that lives in infamy. They'll use that not just for December 7th, but for any date that they feel that, oh, this was a day that will live in infamy. And they're referring back to that historic speech. Interesting to see, now don't forget, this was 1941. There weren't any computers, or I don't even know if there were Xerox machines. If there were, there weren't here. Because they've got the actual paper in the speech. It was typewritten, and that line about a day that will live in infamy, on that the infamy word was added by FDR. He crossed out whatever the speechwriter had written, which was probably a day that will live in our minds, or a day that will live in history, or something like that. Certainly appropriate, but FDR crossed out what was originally written and inserted the whole infamy line. So it's interesting to see some of those things where you see that, you know, he literally he changed that phrasing, and that phrasing is the one that has become this iconic phrase that has lasted for decades. And so, like I said, a little hint, if you're watching Donald Trump give a speech, he'll say something, and what he does when he goes off the teleprompter, he will, if there's something that catches his attention that he wants to really talk about a little more, that's just not, he doesn't feel there's enough oomph in the written, and he wants to expand on it a little more, and that's when he starts to go off on his own. He'll repeat what he just read. And I think that the last line or so, that will give him a little time to gather his thoughts, and then he will begin to just improv and extrapolate on his own. And then you can tell, because then he'll be more gestures. He'll be using his hands more. And he will be looking straight ahead, because now he doesn't need to look at the two little screens on the side for the text, because now he's going off without it. And so you'll always hear him sort of say, if they're said, like, you know, so for instance, he'll say, and that will be an exciting, you know, that was a terrible moment. And he will say in his speech, be saying, and as we look at this terrible moment, then all of a sudden he'll go, terrible, terrible moment. It was a terrible moment. And then he'll take a breath, and a terrible, terrible moment. And then he'll off to the races. And then you'll see he'll go for about a couple of minutes. He'll do some gestures with his hands. And then all of a sudden he'll realize, okay, I'm done. The hands will go back to the podium, and the head and the body will turn to the right or the left, and then all of a sudden he will begin speaking again. And as we know, blah, 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 and it's much more formal. Take a look for that. It's kind of fun and interesting. This is what excites me. But every public speaker has those kind of things, and those little tics and things that, you know, Barack Obama, President Obama, was a great public speaker. And as I said, he is really one where he was always reading a teleprompter, as they all do. They don't memorize these hour-long speeches. But he was very good, and is very good, at being very subtle in his use of the teleprompter. He keeps his head straight a lot, tips it just a little from side to side, but when he does it, it almost looks like he's doing it for emphasis as opposed to doing it for reading. But Trump, you can always tell. Oh, here he goes. There he goes. You can just tell. Terrible. Oh, it's going to be a great, great day. Great day. Great, great, great day. In fact, blah, 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 blah. And then you'll see him look straight ahead, and he'll use both hands to gesture, and he won't do that when he's on the teleprompter. When he's on the teleprompter, he suddenly grabs the podium very strongly and leans to one side or the other as he's reading those little scenes. So that's just a little hint to have a little fun. If you don't really want to listen to a long, boring speech that you may feel is, once again, politics aside, for this reason alone, just watch some of these little things that I've noticed that he does, and that it makes the speeches a little more fun to watch. Let me say that is absolutely nothing to do with what I want to talk about today. As I said, well, that's how you could tell this is a very, you know, I'm already on page, well, I, page 7 here of the script here. It says Jim digresses about President Trump's speeches. No, that's not on the script. No. No, that is, I did, that's not what I want to talk about today. What I did want to talk about today, but once again, hey, we got time, right? Yeah, that's what's great about a podcast. No frantic hurry up and take a break. Take a commercial break. None of that. So, no, what I want to talk about today is somewhat, not serious, but I think is important to talk about. I always like to see what's going on in the news, fun as well as sometimes serious or tragic. And if there's some information or some personal connection or experience that I can add to a big story to help not only personalize it, but bring home a point. I like to do that. And that's happened in the last week or so with, I assume that hopefully most people have heard the news of the death of two-time Oscar winner Gene Hackman, one of the best actors of the last 50 years, through the 70s, 80s, 90s, and even into the early 2000s. He was really one of the most respected and popular and influential actors of our time, dating back all the way to the early 70s when he really exploded on the scene, especially when he played Popeye Doyle in the French Connection films and won an Oscar for the first one. But he was a stage actor for a while. He was on television. There's a show that I watch reruns of. It's called The Invaders. It was from the mid to late 60s. It's kind of a it's a Quinn Martin production. And it's kind of like The Fugitive with David Janssen, only it's about UFOs. It's the same kind of thing where there's a guy that sees a UFO and is trying to tell everybody that these aliens are on the Earth and they want to take over the Earth because their planet is running out of resources and they need to invade another planet, and they've chosen Earth and they've got some big plots going, and he sees the flying saucer one late night, and of course he's trying to spread the word, and this is back in the 60s and nobody's believing him. And it's an interesting show. It's a little corny at times, but I love old TV shows like that, so I do watch it. I don't know. I do record it. It's on at like 4 a.m. on Monday mornings, but I do like to watch it. And this is a show that was on in the mid to late 60s. And one of the reasons I like to watch it is not only the show, like I said, the plot lines are kind of hokey, and it's kind of dated in the whole thing. But what I really enjoy is so oftentimes there are actors and actresses on the show who appear in guest roles who were just starting out, or who were just they were just beginning their careers, and they got a job on this television show, one shot deal. They don't really ever come back. And I remember that Gene Hackman is on one of the episodes of The Invaders, of all things. And it's so, in my mind, it's got to be kind of interesting. I know that Suzanne Pleshette has been in a couple of episodes on that. Ed Asner from the Mary Tyler Moore Show. I'm forgetting a lot of people. There's a lot of people that became very big stars 4 or 5 years later in the early to mid 70s, whether on television or in film. And they are on a lot of these shows from the late to mid to late 60s, because they were just getting their start. And it's fun to see this person where you go, okay, how funny is this that here's Gene Hackman, you know, playing this heavy on this one episode of The Invaders. And I'm sure, you know, and then within 4 or 5 years, he wins an Academy Award, right? But in 1967 or 68 or 69, whenever his episode was, he was just a one-episode player, you know, playing this one little role, was not going to be on the show again. And you know that the regular stars, the regulars of the show, you know, they were all probably like, you know, walking around like they owned the world. Because this is their TV show, especially, and I'm not saying that this is in a bad way. I mean, you know, these are the regulars. It's their show. There's some prestige to that, whether it's a hit show or not. While they're filming it, there is a star of the show. The star of this show is a guy named Ray Thinnes, who never really did much after this show. I don't know anything about him. I don't know if he's a nice guy off screen or not. But I'm just saying is that you can only imagine that, you know, he's the star of the show. And so certainly I'm sure he's treated with a little more, catering to than some actor that just gets a role for this one show. And so I just have to, I always, whenever I see someone like that, who went on to great fame and fortune and notoriety and popularity some years down the line, and then the person who was quote unquote the star of the show didn't really go on to that after this show. But in that little moment, the roles were switched. And, you know, for instance, when Ray Thinnes sees this guy, Gene Hackman, he's like, oh, so, okay, who's the guy? Okay, fine. Blah, 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 blah. Not really paying much attention to him. You know, that show gets canceled. Gene Hackman goes on with his career and then becomes this major, major star for 30 or 40 years. Won 2 Oscars. An interesting little side fun fact about Gene Hackman. Once again, I think talking about, you know, starts and beginnings of careers, especially in the acting world. Gene Hackman was under consideration for Mike Brady of the Brady Bunch. Now, I don't know how far along in the audition process or in the selection process he went, but he was up for the role of the father. And Robert Reed wound up getting the role, and it became his defining role. But how interesting would that have been, and how different might have been the show if Gene Hackman had gotten the role as Mr. Brady? Gene Hackman, just really an actor's actor, a real pro. Not only a lead character, not even a lead actor, but also a great character actor. And even if he wasn't the star of the film, whenever he was on, your attention gravitated to him. He just brought some gravitas to any project or any scene, whether he was the star of it or just had a small supporting role. Whenever he was on, the audience attention was on Gene Hackman. He was that good. And so sadly, I'm sure you've heard the stories, and now we found out the tragic incidences that led up to his death. He was 95 years old. He had been out of films for many years. And he was pretty much out of the public eye, and it sounds as if, I mean, you know, at 95, but he may have been, had some serious health issues, which may have led him to leave the film industry 15 or 20 so years ago. It's been a while since he's made a film. In retrospect, now after he passed away and his body was found, they found that he had quite a few ailments. He had some serious heart disease and some previous heart surgeries and a pacemaker. He had some kidney damage. I mean, the guy was 95. And he also had, it sounds as if he had a very serious case, whatever you want to call it, of Alzheimer's. And so he lived with his wife of several years, who was about 30 years younger than him. She was 65. And sadly, about a month or so ago, 3 weeks ago in late February, their bodies were found dead in their home in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And it was just great a mystery as to what happened. There were no signs of violence or robbery or struggle. So it was clear that some kind of event had occurred that killed them initially. And I also, jumped to this conclusion as well, to find out that, you know, that two people were found dead. There was no violence. Their bodies weren't hurt. There was nothing robbed. Nothing was ransacked. It seemed like the two people just kind of died. Their bodies were found not together in different parts of the house. And in fact, when I talked about how I worked in public relations many years ago, one time I worked for one of the leading companies that, you know, one of our clients was one of the leading companies that make fire alarm, you know, smoke alarms, and also carbon monoxide alarms. And a lot of homes do not have carbon monoxide detectors. Most places do and should, and I think legally are bound to have smoke detectors, but not everybody has a carbon monoxide detector, and you really should. If you don't have one, you really should. Because unlike fire, which you can smell or see smoke, and the alarm goes off and it might awaken you, carbon monoxide, they actually call it the silent killer, and it's very insidious in that you can't see carbon monoxide, you can't smell carbon monoxide, but it is deadly. And if there is a carbon monoxide leak in your house, especially from your furnace or whatever kind of heating system you have, or even air conditioning, but mostly heating system you have in the house, if there is some kind of a leak like that, if you're sleeping and the leak happens, that's it. You will never wake up. And just by the way the bodies were found, the fact that there was no violence, there was no robbery, it appeared, it seemed initially, and that's where the first investigations were going, to check, was there a some kind of a gaseous leak in the house? And that when that was found not to be the case, that there were normal levels, so it was not a carbon monoxide poisoning, then it really became an interesting kind of whodunit, or howdunit, I guess. Not who, because it wasn't a murder or anything, but a howdunit. Like, what happened here? His wife's body, his wife was 65, and Jean was 95. She was found in the bathroom. There were pills that were knocked over on a counter, and her body was there. They sadly had a dog in a crate, and he was dead. They had two other dogs, but they were alive. Gene Hackman was found in a different part of the house, in a different room. So they weren't together. What killed them? How did they die? Who died first? It really was a whodunit. And but as the days and weeks went by, and autopsies were done, and toxicology tests were taken, as well as today with all the technology we have, there's so many surveillance cameras everywhere. They found footage of his wife out and about, literally hours before she passed away. So they knew perhaps when she died, and because of his pacemaker, which is constantly being monitored through technology, they found that his pacemaker was still working about a week after most likely his wife died. So his wife died first, and then he died about a week later. So the idea of them, of this one catastrophic event, for instance, a carbon monoxide leak, excuse me, it would have killed them both instantly. That obviously didn't happen. The levels in their body were not elevated as well. But then, thanks to putting all these things together, not only the autopsies and the toxicology reports, as well as technology, cell phones, surveillance film, they were able to piece together what happened. And apparently, it was just as odd and mysterious as it appeared, to some extent, which is kind of my point here. As it turned out, sadly, his wife, who was Gene Hackman's primary caregiver, the two lived alone, big house with a couple of dogs, I think three dogs, but it was just the two of them. And she decided to take on the role of his primary caregiver. But apparently she contracted a very rare virus that is inhaled, which is spread from rodent droppings that get into the air, and they attack the lungs when you breathe in this poisonous virus, this killer virus that just attacks the lungs, and it's pretty merciless, and it's once it does its job, death comes very quickly. Sad part is that the symptoms of that, it's called the Hanta virus. Very rare, but apparently it does show up in the Southwest and in the New Mexico area, because it's passed by some kind of a very specific mouse, and it's hard to tell where she contracted this. It's not like the house was in squalor or anything. There weren't, you know, these mice droppings around the house that anybody could find, but I guess they had a barn or some kind of another structure. So perhaps she was in there cleaning or something, because obviously Gene Hackman didn't inhale this disease. So it couldn't have really been in the house. She had to have come in contact with it singularly. It wasn't something that was around the house that he could have also inhaled. They both didn't die from it, just she did. But what's kind of insidious about this virus and this disease is not only is it pretty much fatal, but it takes a while to have its impact, and the initial symptoms that it has before it really does its major damage and can kill you is that the symptoms are very common, almost like the flu or the cold. So she may have been coughing, she may have had some difficulty breathing, but she may have just thought that she had a cold. In fact, the footage of her doing some errands the day that she died, she was up and about walking around. She went to a grocery store, and she went to several places. But she did have a mask on, a breathing mask. So perhaps, you know, she was beginning to feel the serious implications and symptoms of this very rare disease, because she's just probably coughing a lot. And so when she was going to go out in public, she's like, oh, I have a cold here, I'm going to wear my mask because I don't want to keep coughing on people. But sadly, she really had no idea that she had this deadly virus in her body that was wreaking havoc. And sometime after she returned from these errands, it sounds like she just died instantly. That as soon as this virus attacks the lungs, then all the organs begin to break down, and so sadly she dies in one part of the house. And given Gene Hackman's situation, especially with his advanced case of Alzheimer's, the question is, you know, he lived for a week before she died, and he may not have even known that she died. And he may have died. I mean, obviously he had some kind of a cardiac arrest at the end, but it sounds like he didn't have much food, if any food, in his stomach. So sadly, he may have died of starvation or of dehydration, because he wasn't remembering to eat. You know, that was her job. And without her there, he may have just been, you know, kind of oblivious to his surroundings and to the reality of the situation. And then sadly, died of that. Not so much of some kind of event. Yeah, he may have had a heart attack, but it probably most likely was caused by the fact that he wasn't eating or drinking any water. And that certainly, especially if someone of his age, he wasn't taking his medication, So all these things add up, and because his body, he sounded like, looked like he just kind of collapsed in this other part of the house. So he may not even have known that she was dead. He probably didn't even know where she was or anything like that. So it's a very sad ending, regardless of whether it's a celebrity or not. It's a sad ending. And it really, when you start to hear the timeline of this and the realities of this, from my standpoint, it really struck home to me, because I am a very strong advocate of caregivers. And I say that because I've talked about this a few times over the years here on the podcast, my parents both got sick around the same time, which eventually led to both of their deaths within a 3-year period. And for 3 years, my wife and I were the primary caregivers for my mom. And my dad's situation was a little more serious, both physically as well as mentally, with dementia. And so he was actually in a facility because he needed around-the-clock care. And my mom didn't initially, but then her situation began to deteriorate. But at least there were, my wife and I were here. There were two of us. And it was 20 years ago, so we were a lot younger too. And, I've become such an advocate of that because there is still a stigma in the world, especially in this country, about people going to a healthcare facility, whether it's an assisted living facility or an Alzheimer's unit or a nursing home, whatever that means. I mean, that term has been demonized for years. And yeah, 30, 40, 50 years ago, a nursing home was kind of a place that was very institutionalized, and it really was a place where people, when they went there, they were near death, and so the connotation was, well, when someone gets taken to a nursing home, they're ready to die type of thing. And we're realizing now more with time and more information, and more understanding of different diseases, as well as we have an aging population, people living longer, it's becoming a more accepted and more enlightened way to say, the longer people live, people need help. And while there's no, I understand the initial drive for people to say, I'm going to take care of my sibling, or I'm going to take care of my parent. I'm not going to send them to one of those places. First of all, there's a lot of situations. There's a lot of layers to that. They are very expensive because of the kind of care and safety that they provide. There is this negative connotation of it. There are, stories of elder abuse and many facilities sometimes not providing the right kind of care. So like everything else in our society, in our world, there's nothing perfect. However, what we often see so many times is that we see a tragedy like this. Now, by all accounts, for many years, Gene Hackman's wife was a very diligent and caring and loving caregiver, and apparently he had told friends that I would have been dead a long time ago if not for her. So certainly she did a very good job of taking care of his needs. But then she began, but then as time goes on, she becomes older. And she becomes susceptible. And in many cases, because the stress of the situation to care for somebody can be great, and believe me, I know it from firsthand experience, oftentimes the caregiver neglects their own health, neglects their own warning signs. and is taking on so much more responsibility and anxiety and stress because it's not easy, because the average person is not trained professionally to handle the realities of somebody with a very serious mental or physical disease. And of course, our emotions get involved. So that adds another layer. And so there's a resistance to have professionals either come in part-time or full-time, or to actually have someone go to a facility. As I've said many times on here, it was a very difficult, probably the taking care of my parents was and hopefully will be the most difficult decisions I've ever had to make in my life. And I hope I never need to make those anymore. Because it's literally the weight of the world. Not easy. And you have to distance yourself and separate yourself from your emotions and from the reality. You have to look at things in a more objective way and try to take your emotions out of it and be honest with yourself and honest with the situation. Because at the end of the day, if your goal is to provide the best care and safety for your loved one, you have to be honest with yourself and say, can I really provide that? Now, as I said, there's a lot of financial situations that revolve around this too. But there are also agencies and programs that can help out. They're not perfect. They can drain people's savings. I understand that. But if your goal, and if you love this person in your life, whoever it may be, parent, spouse, sibling, child, whoever it is, if you really care about them, you have to really look inside yourself and say, can I provide the best care? Can I really provide a safe environment for this person on my own? And in my situation, because both of my parents, and I'm an only child, so there was no handing off, like, well, one sibling or two siblings do this. It was just me. And so my parents were dependent on me. And so I had two situations to deal with at the same time. And so I had to look at it from a very objective point of view as to who was sicker in terms of the seriousness of their ailments, both mentally and physically. And who could we at least, and who could we might be able to take care of on our own as well from the financial burdens and things like that. So as I said, there's so many factors in this. And so what I'm most proud of, the most difficult decision of my life for both my parents, but at the same time, as difficult and as controversial and as divisive as the decisions I had to make turned out, I'm very happy that in the end of the day, the choices that I made for the welfare and the safety and the health of each of my parents, they both passed away being cared for. They didn't hurt themselves. They didn't hurt anyone else. And they died peacefully. There was no tragedies in their passing. And so for that reason, even though the decisions I made were not popular within my family and led to some very serious estrangements that continue today, my view had to be solely on the welfare and the health of my parents. And so I sleep very well at night in knowing that I made the decisions that had to be made, if the goal was that they would be taken care of, that they would get the help that they needed, and that they would be safe. And that is what happened. And in this situation with Gene Hackman, I couldn't help but, you know, immediately think back to my situation and say, obviously his wife for many years was caring and attentive and diligent, and she may have helped keep him alive for many more years because of that. No question. But as time goes on, the caregiver is not a robot, and the caregiver is susceptible. Now, granted, in this situation, this was a rare, how she caught this disease. It wasn't like she had cancer or something like that. This was something that she contracted. It killed her very quickly. I'll give you that. But at the same time, there wasn't a fallback in case something happened. I mean, what if she fell upstairs or somewhere in the house and broke her leg and was unable to walk, or hit her head and was unconscious for a week or something? The same thing. In the case of Gene Hackman, one of the most successful actors in Hollywood, lived in a big house in a gated community. I think that I find it hard to believe that Gene Hackman, if they wanted to live at home, if they didn't want him to go to a facility, even though it sounds like he had some very serious Alzheimer's toward the end, regardless of how diligent she was, sadly, when she was gone, he was alone. And I'm just surprised, and I'm saddened by the fact that for people of means, the financial factor of this was really not into play. And if there was still this stigma, like, oh, well, I don't want to put him in a facility or something like that, I understand that still exists, that stigma. But here's the result. At the very least, I'm surprised that they didn't have someone either around the clock to help her out. I mean, now she's 65 years old. She's not moving as fast as she was. She's aging, obviously susceptible to diseases. Like I said, granted, it's a rare disease and this was an oddity, but it still happened. But she didn't have any help. She had no backup. 20 years ago, perhaps she didn't need that backup. But at 65, you know, you need some backup. We all have to face those facts. And not only was she perhaps slowing down, but his situation, she's 30 years younger. He's 30 years older. His situation was now more serious. From all indications, he had a very advanced case of Alzheimer's, which obviously he did, because that's what ultimately killed him, being oblivious to the situation and not eating, not taking his medication, not drinking, because she was doing that for him. So he must have been in a really advanced state. So given that fact, yes, it's hard to accept it. Believe me, I had to watch both my parents go through that. It's not easy. As I've said many times here, when your mom looks you straight in the eye and asks you, "Are you my brother?" That'll knock you over. That'll knock you for a loop. Believe me. But that's the reality of it. When you get a call at the middle of the night, before my dad was in the facility, to say you have to come over here because he's not acting right at 3 a.m, and I come over and he's ranting and raving and talking about stuff. It's clear something's wrong here. It's not easy to see your parents in that kind of state or that kind of distress, but you can't pretend it's not real, and you can't pretend that it'll go away. And once again, I don't know the situation with her, but my point is, it's a shame that they didn't have someone else to help out. If they didn't want to have a live-in person there 24 hours, if she still felt like she can handle it, once again, I understand that. Okay, I don't agree with it, but okay, I understand the way people think. You know, I can do it. Nobody can give them the care that I can. Nobody can give them the love. That's true. But professional caregivers know how to handle the results and the consequences of these different ailments and these different mental as well as physical things. They're trained to handle them. They know the signs. They know what it is. They know how to either stop it or alleviate it or control it or decide it's time to go to another situation here. This person needs more care. If you're not a professional doctor or a professional caregiver, I'm not discounting the love factor, the care factor. That's huge. But you still don't have the expertise, especially when you get to somebody with an advanced case of Alzheimer's disease. It's a horrendous disease. If you love somebody, it is hard to watch them in that situation, because you're thinking of them not as they are, but as they were. But they need you to be in the moment, because their care and their safety depends on that. And an outside person, while they are empathetic and compassionate people, they have to be in that line of work. They don't have that emotional 50, 60 year emotional connection to this person. And so while they feel compassion and empathy for the person, and maybe even a connection, they can still separate that and do what needs to be done in the reality of the illness and the reality of the situation. And in this case with Gene Hackman, perfect example. Even if they didn't want to put him in a facility, even though he had advanced Alzheimer's, okay, I don't agree with that, but that was the decision. Even if his wife believed that I've been his caregiver for 30 years, or for 20 years, or I don't know however long he's been sick now, maybe even longer. I know what I'm doing. I have this under control. Yes, you do. But now you're getting older and you're getting a little weaker. You're human. You're slowing down. And his disease is getting harder to handle. It's not a bad thing against this person to say I now need help to help him. You have to be honest with yourself. If you really love that person who needs the real help, to say, you know what, I can help, but I need help helping. There's nothing wrong with that. And in this case, I don't believe that expenses or finances were a problem. So if you didn't want to send him to a facility, oh, I want him to be in his surroundings. Okay, that's fine. No, I don't want someone living in my house. It's just the two of us. We don't want to have to rearrange our lives. I can handle it. I've been handling it for 25 years, whatever it's been. Okay, fine. But you're getting older and his situation is getting worse. We have to realize, we have to face reality. Even if they had somebody that came in part-time, that was there from 8 in the morning till 5 in the evening, that was just there in case, to give his wife a little break from the constant need, which I'm sure toward the end of his life he needed around-the-clock care. If he was truly with such an advanced case of Alzheimer's, he needed constant attention. So just from her own standpoint, you know, you say, well, how did she catch this disease? You know, okay, it was a freak thing. But perhaps her body was weakened. Perhaps her immune system has been weakened over the last 2 or 3 years or 5 years, because she's getting older. His situation is getting more serious, more in the need of more attention. And she's giving him that attention, to her credit. But now she is weakening herself. Perhaps 20 years ago, the virus that killed her may not have killed her 20 years ago because her immune system and her health was stronger. But 20 or 30 years later, she's more susceptible to something like this. But perhaps if she had help, if you don't want an around-the-clock person, if you don't want to put them in a facility, even if they had someone who came in for half a day from 8 to 5, this situation, as tragic as it is, would not have had the same outcome. Yes, you know, perhaps once again, maybe she, you know, with a little rest that during the day without having to be running around constantly, taking care of him, doing errands around the house, taking care of dogs. This woman was really working hard, to her credit. But she was probably getting run down herself, which made her susceptible to some kind of disease. If she had help, okay, you know what? She could rest a while. She can run some errands while someone else is taking care of Gene Hackman. So her health might have been a little stronger. Also, if they had a regular person that, say, came from 9 and stayed till 5, okay, so they believe that she died sometime after 5 o'clock. She was out running errands. I'm surprised that she left him alone in the house to run these errands, given his situation. But, okay, she did. She came home. He was clearly alive. We know that by his pacemaker readings. But she comes home, but sometime after 5 o'clock, she succumbs to this virus. And now Gene Hackman, with advanced Alzheimer's and other ailments, is on his own. And he cannot take care of himself in any way. He lived a week after she died. They wonder if he even knew she was dead, given his situation. He didn't call anybody. He didn't say, hey, Betsy is dead. Betsy's on the ground. So he clearly didn't have any idea what was happening to him. But my point is, if they did have even a part-time caregiver who came in every day, who stayed from 9 o'clock till 5 o'clock, that person would have come in the next day. Let's say that his wife died at 6 o'clock on the 11th, or whenever the day is that they had said. Let's say that she died on that day. Okay, Gene Hackman would have been alone from 5 o'clock through the night, but the next morning, the caregiver would have come home, would have come over. She would have discovered the wife's body. She would have found Gene Hackman somewhere having not eaten from whenever he hadn't eaten or whatever. Who knows what shape he was in, but at least we know he was alive. She would have called the authorities, and Gene Hackman most likely would not have died. The wife's situation, as I said before, who knows? Her being the primary and only caregiver may have weakened her. Maybe that's how she got inhaled this and it affected her body because her immune system was weak. But regardless, whether it was a freak accident, when she died, the caregiver would have been there the next morning. And instead of Gene Hackman being alone for more than a week until he collapsed and died, most likely from starvation or dehydration or lack of medication, most likely he would not have died. Her situation is freaky. It's odd. It's tragic. But what was even more tragic is that they both died. The dog died because nobody was feeding or giving the dog anything. Apparently the dog had some surgery a week or so before. That's why he was in a crate. The other dogs apparently were able to go outside and have some food or something. They had some water. Now, where they got that, I don't know. They said that the doors were open, so Gene Hackman was obviously walking around. He was near a door in a mudroom by a door. Maybe he had been letting the dogs out. At least he had that cognizance. You know, they were walking around. He saw them. He was aware of them, probably. But then after a week, his body gave out. My point is, this was a tragic ending for two people. And if you look at it from a realistic standpoint, if there was a caregiver situation in this situation for the last several years, either part-time or full-time, or if there was some kind of a facility to help him as his health completely declined, odds are he would most likely still be alive. And perhaps she would too, because you cannot gauge the kind of impact that being a full-time sole caregiver for somebody with the ailments that he had, what kind of toll it took on her health, the stress, the anxiety, the work. If this was a freak thing that she contracted and it would have killed anybody, perhaps that's the case. Tragic as it is, Gene Hackman most likely would not have died in the way that he died, kind of oblivious and not even knowing of where he was and what was happening. Apparently, I guess he has some kids from another marriage. I don't know where they live. There wasn't a lot of contact. That's another situation that who knows. But my point is, this seemed like a preventable situation. This was a tragedy. This, what happened here, is exactly what I didn't want to happen to my parents. And that's when I look back at the decisions I made, as difficult as they were to make, and the consequences that they had, I put the health and welfare and safety of my parents above all other considerations and looked at it from a very realistic standpoint as to how do they get the best care possible given our situation. And in the case of Gene Hackman, I wish somebody would have been able to intervene there and explain and try to say, okay, look, I understand you've been doing a great job, but you need a break, Betsy. So can't we have a part-time caregiver just to come in, just to be around in case you need a little break, in case you want to just relax a little and help you with this? Just so there's someone else in case. And so I, my parents were older. So this really, you know, when this happened to me 20 years ago, most of my friends were not experiencing this at all. Their parents were younger. But now, many of them are experiencing this. And they probably couldn't understand it when I was doing it 20 years ago. And I have been always, I'm like, look, I will be happy to explain things and give you my insights. It's your decision. But here's what I found. And as I said, at the end of the day, when I see the fact that my parents were cared for, they didn't hurt themselves, they didn't hurt anyone else, there was no tragic end, they died peacefully and naturally, I have to think that I did, at least in my mind, I'm happy with my decision. I've had to live with the consequences of those decisions that other people didn't agree with, but it was my responsibility. They were my parents. And there's times when you just have to stand up and make those decisions, as hard and as devastating as they may be. And so I would just urge anybody, whatever situation, whatever age you're in, but just keep this in mind. There doesn't need to be a stigma of getting help. Caregivers, the people that we did used to use some people with my mom as well, even though there was my wife and I. We still needed help. We were going to work and jobs and things. My dad was being cared for at the facility. We knew that was taken care of, but my mom's situation was different, and it began to decline, and we needed help. And I'll tell you, the caregivers that we had, mostly part-time people, just the nicest, compassionate, helpful, understanding people. Even the people that worked in the hospice, for both my parents as well. It's a special person that goes into this caregiving line of work. But they are, I believe, from all the ones that I dealt with, they are naturally compassionate and empathetic, but they are also trained. They also are ready for what's next. They know the symptoms. They know the situation, and they're trained to handle it. And they do have that objectivity of what needs to be done here. Oh, don't do that yet. Yeah, well, I'm sorry, I have to do it because this person's in trauma right now, or this person's in distress right now. The loved one might not. They're looking at their emotions are involved. And meanwhile, the person that you love so much that you, in your mind, you want the best for them, you're actually doing the opposite by not facing the realities and facing the reality that you cannot provide the care that a professional can. Yes, you can provide the love, you can provide the concern. But as a disease, especially with something like Alzheimer's or something serious, The consequences and the symptoms and the results of this disease, we're not prepared for. It's not your fault. You're not trained to do it. You're not a lesser person. It's not that you love the person any less. And I would argue you love them even more because you're trying to do the best for them. And sometimes the best is something that you can't provide. As I've said many times, when I have a plumbing problem, I call a plumber. When I have an electricity problem, I call an electrician. I call the expert. Same thing here. I didn't feel like I was shucking any responsibility. In fact, what I felt, I was doing the most responsible thing. I was not trained, nor could I provide the help, the care that my father needed, given the advanced part of his dementia situation. Couldn't do it. Same thing with my mom. So I would just urge everybody, when you see something like this, this was a sad situation with Gene Hackman. It was a tragedy on many levels, but sadly, if we take a step back, it's a situation that might have been prevented. And so often the case, we forget about the health of the caregiver. And the caregiver forgets about their health because they are so dedicated. Don't get me wrong. I am not blaming Gene Hackman's wife. I believe it sounds as if she was so in love and so devoted to him and so dedicated to him, and she wanted to take care of him. That is so admirable. But I guarantee you that somewhere down the line, she began to ignore her own health and her own well-being because she was so consumed. And that doesn't help the situation either. Caregivers need a break. Caregivers need assistance, especially as they get older. And we've got to cut through these stigmas. We've got to cut through these notions and try to deal with reality. And believe me, I hope that none of you go through this situation. But if you do somewhere down the line, maybe you're involved in it now. But maybe as time goes on, I would just keep this in mind. At least try to understand what my experience is, and what I'm trying to impress onto you is that you are being as loving, you are being as dedicated, you are being as committed, you are being as caring to your loved one, if you admit that you can't help them completely and that you need help from a caregiver, you are being just as loving as you as if you say, I'm going to do this. And maybe for a while you can, but there comes a time when that person needs more help. Their situation will never get better than it was yesterday. They're always declining. And then you're getting older and you're beginning to decline in some ways. So I just hope that that people see this situation and perhaps learn a lesson, because it was really sad. It's sad that both people had to die. How in her very freak weird way that she died, and it's sad that Gene Hackman had to die in the way he did. Perhaps neither of them would have died if there was a caregiver situation involved in this somewhere down the line several years ago on a regular basis. Maybe she wouldn't have contracted that disease. But I can almost be positive that if there was a caregiver that even came in part-time every day, stayed there for 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 hours, Gene Hackman would not have been alone for a week. Gene Hackman would have been taken care of. Gene Hackman would have been fed. The dog would have been fed. Gene Hackman would have been hydrated, got his medications, and Gene Hackman most likely would be alive, as well as the poor dog. There's nobody at fault here. I just think there's a misunderstanding, and we need to get through that and realize that admitting that you can't be the caregiver is not shucking or putting aside your obligation and your love for that loved one. In fact, in my view, it's the honesty you're having with yourself is even a more loving expression. This person needs help. I have to put away my own ego, my own emotions, and realize that I want to give that person the best health or care they can get. And I can't provide that. So then it's my job to make sure that person gets it. If I can't personally provide it, at least let me bring someone who can. As I said, there's such a stigma here that I hope we can get through this, because this is going to continue to be a problem in our society as people live longer. I'm sure that, sadly, every family is going to be touched by something like this somewhere down the line, because we're living longer. And while we are keeping people alive, we are not necessarily keeping them taken care of as well as they should have. We need to, we've been able to advance in the area of life extension, but we're still in the dark ages, I believe, in the terms of life quality and life care. If you are a caregiver, believe me, I think you do God's work. And I wish that more people would realize the important work and the good work that you do to provide the health and safety that their loved ones need. It's sad that we have to see something like this to learn a lesson, but I hope that Gene Hackman's really sad situation doesn't go without at least somebody learning a lesson. Love comes in many ways. And sometimes you are showing the most love by being honest with yourself and doing the best that you can for a loved one. And sometimes it's not just doing it personally, but it's making the decisions that will help them live the final years in safety and in quality. Just a thought. And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new podcast is posted at WGMRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. And don't forget to tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. Hope you enjoyed episode number 460. I'm Jim Tirano. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. You've been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. From the end of my mind to your ears.